welcome to Inside the New York Times Book Review. I'm Sam Tannenhaus. This week, Charles Isherwood, one of the Times' theater critics, revisits the remarkable life of playwright Ben Jonson.
He wrote about himself a lot. You know, he wrote a lot of prologues and epilogues to his plays explaining what he was trying to do and who he was.
Julie Bosman has notes from the field, and Gregory Coles has bestseller news.
This podcast is brought to you by Audible.com, the internet's leading provider of audiobooks with more than 100,000 downloadable titles across all types of literature, including fiction, nonfiction, and periodicals. For a free audiobook of your choice, go to audiblepodcast.com/bookreview.
The continuing presence of William Shakespeare is so enormous that it sometimes obscures some of the other really great writers who were his contemporaries. One such is Ben Jonson. There's an ambitious new biography of him. It's called Ben Jonson, A Life. It's by Ian Donaldson, and it's reviewed for us by none other than the Times' great theater critic, Charles Isherwood, who's here to talk about it. Welcome, Charles.
Thank you.
Ben Jonson, tell us briefly who he was and why he matters.
Well, he was a contemporary of Shakespeare's. Shakespeare was sort of at his height when Jonson was beginning his career. So he has been somewhat overshadowed. But in many ways, Jonson was much more ambitious about making the playwright an important literary figure. I mean, Shakespeare was sort of happy to be writing his plays and performing in them. Jonson really insisted that his be published, and that was very rare at the time. In fact, when he had a folio collection of his works published in 1616, it was considered he seemed an upstart. Like, you know, playwrights really think that collected works are worth, you know, being published.
Now, what about Jonson's background, Charles? We don't know very much at all, actually, about Shakespeare, but we have a sense that he kind of came through the world of theater. He had some education, but he was not one of these truly learned university men of his time who mastered classical languages and all the rest. What about Jonson's history?
Well, Jonson was a much more deeply versed classical scholar. He was the son of a stepson, rather, of a bricklayer. But he managed to get a scholarship to a very good school, the Westminster School in London. So he got a really good grounding in the classics, and that is reflected in all of his poetry and much of his playwriting, too.
And what are the lasting plays? There are some that are still performed.
They're very rarely performed. Volpone, of course, is his most famous play, but many people probably know it from the Larry Gelbart adaptation Sly Fox. It's a satire of, you know, human greed and avarice and folly, but it's a very funny play. It's also very dark, which is, I think, one of the reasons why his comedies are not quite as beloved as Shakespeare's, because there's a warmth to Shakespeare's comedies. And Jonson's can be very savage. They're very scabrous. There's also The Alchemist, which is, once again, a satire of human stupidity, but a very vital play, a very funny one, that is often done. But, you know, you usually see them cut or adapted because the language is very, very complicated. He was writing in a more contemporary voice than Shakespeare, in a way. Shakespeare wrote of mythical, you know, places and ancient kings. And Jonson was writing sort of about contemporary London, and these people have, you know, voices of contemporary Londoners, which are in a way even more remote than, you know, Shakespeare's kings.
Now, what about the relationship between the two? They knew each other?
They did. Shakespeare acted in a couple of Jonson's plays. And, you know, people have tried to make much of a few stray comments that Jonson made. It's a bit of hearsay. One of the most famous things he supposedly said was that he wanted art. People have taken that to mean that he was not a great fan of Shakespeare's work. But, of course, he's more famous for writing a wonderful eulogy that was put in the folio of Shakespeare's works published, you know, after his death.
And how long did Jonson live? Did he become a truly celebrated figure in his time, or died as a distinguished literary man, or
well,
not?
It's very complicated because considering his humble beginnings, he actually made his way in the world very impressively, far more than Shakespeare. He wrote, you know, many masks for the court of King James that, you know, and that was a rare privilege. But he was also destitute half the time. You know, he said at one point that he didn't make as much as £200 from all of his playwriting. And he died, you know, toward the end of his life. he was having to write begging letters to patrons asking for money.
What about Ian Donaldson? Has he given us a rich and interesting portrait of Johnson? Does he did he tell you things you didn't know?
Well, certainly. He is the leading scholar, I think, in the world of Johnsoniana, whatever you want to call it. And in fact, he's one of the editors of the upcoming Cambridge edition of his works. He's obviously been at work on this book for many years. It's capacious, it's thorough, but it's also a very lively read because he's a very fluent writer. But also Johnson is just such an interesting figure. I mean, he killed somebody in a duel. He fought wars in the Netherlands. He didn't just, sit around writing plays and poems.
Why do we know so much more about him than about Shakespeare?
Well, because he was a much more established public figure. I mean, he did have many patrons at court. But also, he wrote about himself a lot. He was very good at, he wrote a lot of prologues and epilogues to his plays explaining what he was trying to do and who he was. So I think that's one of the reasons why Shakespeare, he wrote his plays and he wrote his sonnets, of course. But he didn't spend a lot of time, volubly talking about himself. And he wasn't quite the, hard-drinking, hard-playing, boisterous, garrulous fellow that Johnson was. So many people write more about Johnson because he was just a bigger figure in many ways.
And with Shakespeare, the genius went into the work.
Yeah, exactly.
Thanks so much, Charles.
Thank you.
That's Charles Isherwood, who reviews Ben Johnson, A Life, on the cover of this week's book review.
This podcast is brought to you by Audible.com, the internet's leading provider of audiobooks with more than 100,000 downloadable titles across all types of literature and featuring audio versions of many New York Times bestsellers. For listeners of this podcast, Audible is offering a free audiobook to give you a chance to try out their service. One audiobook to consider is Boomerang, Travels in the New Third World by best-selling author Michael Lewis. The Times' Machiko Kakutani says no one writes with more narrative panache about money and finance than Lewis. That's Boomerang by Michael Lewis. It's available on Audible. For a free audiobook of your choice, go to audiblepodcast.com/bookreview. That's audiblepodcast.com/bookreview.
Julie Bosman's here with Notes from the Field. Hi, Julie.
Hi, Sam.
So, Julie, politicians' wives or spouses are getting into the book act.
Yes. In a campaign year, it never hurts to have a children's book. And this one is written by Dr. Jill Biden, who is an English teacher. She teaches to college and high school students. And she's written a book called Don't Forget Nana, God Bless Our Troops. This book is going to come out in June. And, this is a long tradition, especially in a campaign year, to come out with a children's story. Biden's predecessor, Liz Cheney, wrote a book, several books, actually, about history for young people. She also wrote a racy novel called Sisters that I believe is out of print, but that's another topic. And President Obama wrote a children's book called Of Thee I Sing, which sold many, many copies when it came out about 2 years ago.
Julie, Liz Cheney, when she was married to the vice president, was actually quite a prominent, visible figure. She'd been chairwoman of the National Endowment for the Humanities, and at some points was actually better known than her husband. But do we know much about Jill Biden? Is she a public figure? Does she have a public persona?
She has been a pretty understated second lady. She's someone who said that she really wanted to keep her career. She has been a college professor. She also teaches high school students. And, she said that she didn't really want to let that go when her husband became vice president. You might remember when they first moved to Washington, they said that they really wanted to, also keep their home in Delaware, that they hoped that they could sort of commute. Vice President Biden is famous for his love of Amtrak, Amtrak Joe, as he was known. But she has been a second lady who's sort of stayed in the background. I think that I've seen her appear a lot with Michelle Obama at events for military families. You know, if she has any kind of platform, you could say that that is one of them.
Do we know when this book will be published?
It will be published in June by Simon & Schuster Books for Young Readers.
Thanks so much, Julie.
Thanks, Sam.
Gregory Coles is here with Bestseller News. Hey, Greg.
Hi, Sam.
What's on the list this week?
Well, starting on the hardcover nonfiction side of things, there are four new titles. The first one is The Obamas by our own Jody Kantor, new at number 6. Then moving down the list, we have a biography of Queen Elizabeth called Elizabeth the Queen by Sally Bedell Smith, new at number 8. At number 9, a new book called Greedy Bastards by the MSNBC host Dylan Radigan. And down at number 15, Pity the Billionaire by Thomas Frank, which I predicted a few weeks ago would make the list and which we reviewed on our cover.
So rich people and royalty making their way up the list. What about fiction?
On the fiction side, there are 5 new titles, including the top of the list, a new book by the crime writer Elizabeth George, Believing the Lie, that's part of her Thomas Linley series set in England. Number 3 is Gideon's Corpse by Douglas Preston and Lincoln Child. Number 4, a new Star Wars novel, Darth Plagueis by James Luceno. Down at number 8 is Jane Ann Krentz's new romance, Copper Beach. That's a paranormal romance. And then at number 9 is Cressley Cole's Lothair, a vampire novel.
Now, Jane Ann Krentz, I'm not familiar with her, but you say she's actually a big figure in the romance world.
She has been a mainstay of the fiction list for a long time. She's had more than 30 New York Times bestsellers going back to at least the 90s. Her first novel came out in 1979, and she's built a real following. She's also become kind of a spokesman for the romance genre as a whole. She has her Master's of Library Science, and early in her career, she worked as an academic librarian, including at Duke University. So she knows how to frame her advocacy of romance novels in language that owes something to cultural studies or critical theory. She even edited an anthology back in 1992, Dangerous Men and Adventurous Women, which was published by the University of Pennsylvania. And she talks about the genre as a descendant of the heroic tradition in literature, celebrating virtues like honor or courage or determination and upholding the power of love. On the other hand, she argues that by putting these values in stories with women at the center instead of men, romances are actually deeply subversive and feminist. They overturn the idea of the traditional masculine hero and, in fact, bring him to his knees. So her arguments don't always add up. In one sentence, she challenges the idea that romances are formulaic, and she says, you know, look how many different kinds of romance there are. How can there be a formula? And then in the next sentence, she applauds romances because the women always win and love conquers all, which, you know, sounds a lot like a formula to me. But that's okay. She's more a lobbyist than a disinterested academic. And her defense doesn't need to make perfect sense to give you something to think about while you're reading her steamy paranormal sex scenes.
So she's not exactly the Henry James of her field, both a practitioner and high-caliber theorist.
No, she's not, in fact, a big thinker. She's throwing a lot of arguments out there. She can sound a little defensive, but she does have a real thesis. It doesn't always add up when you actually look at the books, but it gives you something to chew on.
Well, most theses don't add up to much. Thanks a lot, Greg.
Thanks, Sam.
Thanks for listening. And remember, there's more at nytimes.com/books. You can tell us what you think of this show or any New York Times podcast by emailing podcasts@nytimes.com. I'm Sam Tannenhaus.